Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I put one line in there saying workplace entrenched culture or bullying intimidation, which I've experienced from the opposition and from within my own party. Mm. Those were the deadly words because I
didn't
realise.
You mean like the traitorous words?
The traitorous words. Yeah. She's a traitor, treachery, terrible, horrible. Let's make her, you know, let's take her through the sexist spectrum somehow. Let's silence her. Let's create fear. All of those things. I didn't realise that I would, with those words, become the whistleblower.
Rolling now. Hello, lovely people, and welcome to the show. You're with Catherine Murphy, the host of this pod and a political editor of Guardian Australia. And I'm so delighted because I haven't seen Julia, well, since you left.
Yeah, this is my first time back to Canberra since 2019.
Are you stressed walking around?
It was interesting.
Put it that way. Look, we'll get to that. Sorry, we're racing ahead and I'm not following good podcast practice at all. My guest, of course, if you haven't recognised the voice, is Julia Banks, whose memoir about her life in corporate Australia and the rather interesting experiences that she that she had in political life is hitting the bookshelves. This week, isn't it?
Yeah, today.
Woo! Yeah. Okay, all right. Yeah. Just for the record, we're recording on Thursday, everyone, so you'll hear this on Saturday. So anyway, Julia is in Canberra, so I'm delighted we can do this face-to-face rather than remotely. And she's in town for an event tonight, and we thought this would be a really good opportunity for us to catch up. So sorry, we're just going to bore you with our catch-up, guys. But there's lots of interesting things that Julia's memoir brings into the public domain, but there's a bunch of other things that I have been dying to talk to her about in a conversation that others could hear, just about her experience moving from corporate life to politics in the election where you won the only seat, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
In Chisholm. Yeah, took the only seat from Labor. Okay, we'll start there.
Okay.
With taking the only seat from Labor in the last federal election. So you were a corporate counsel, a lawyer. You had experience in a number of big companies. You win pre-selection, you win the seat, you arrive in Canberra to your new political life.
Mm-hmm.
What happens?
Well, I'd sort of been relatively high alert because it really, the different culture, I guess a lot of people don't appreciate this from the outside world, but the political world doesn't operate like a parent company overseeing, you know, all the sort of subsidiary companies like the different states. The political animal is largely driven out of the states before you get to Canberra.
Mm.
And I'd experienced a highly, you know, sexist sort of toxic culture almost from day one, very exceedingly sexist culture. I describe it in the book, Catherine, as, you know, Mad Men meets House of Cards. It was just sort of really,
really weird.
And I was asked to run for pre-selection for a seat that no one in the Liberals cared about at that time because it had been held by Labor for over 18 years. There was very little hope of winning that seat.
Yeah.
And then I guess, yeah, 2016, the night it all happened, when Anthony Green called it, it was the only seat we won from Labor and served my term under Malcolm Turnbull. You know, I joined the Liberal Party. I've not been a political animal. I didn't engage in student politics. I'd been an observer of the political world, obviously, doing my corporate career, working in my corporate career. And the Liberal Party were calling for more women. I saw good moderates such as Kelly O'Dwyer and Malcolm Turnbull and Julie Bishop there. And I joined the party and then asked to run for pre-selection. I was even told you won't win pre-selection because you're new. You know, you're new to the party.
You haven't served your time.
But there weren't many people interested, so they thought, oh, well, we'll let it run. And then I won. But it wasn't a heavily contested pre-selection by any stretch of the imagination. But if I do any job, I want to do it properly. And so it all started with the phone calls that you have to do if you're running for pre-selection. And I remember, you know, diligently having my plan there and making these phone calls after work. And I rang a few members and then told a branch official I'd rung so-and-so. And he said to me, oh, look, you should have called me first so I can check that they're safe.
What does that mean?
And that's exactly what I asked him. And it was sort of like, safe? I mean, I haven't got the Labor Party list here, have I? Like, I just thought, what am I doing here? But look, I guess the difference between the fundamental difference, and a lot of my corporate colleagues and friends ask me this, is what's the biggest difference? And the biggest difference is, you know, in any sort of in my corporate and my legal life, even when you change jobs, you change employers, you change workplace cultures, you nonetheless go in with high trust unless someone disabuses that trust. And I've worked in the robust areas of litigation and corporate deals and all the rest of it, but you fundamentally trust people, you know, and I'm firmly of the view that everyone's got good somewhere there, and I, you know, trust someone until they disabuse that trust.
Yeah.
In the political realm, it is the complete opposite. And it was, you know, the first bit of advice I got, which was don't trust anyone, you know, check that people are safe. And it's almost an entirely different way of thinking. It's quite extraordinary.
And I'm asking Julia these questions because, as she's laid out, she's not, you didn't come up through, well, the increasingly traditional channels of being a staffer or being an apparatchik. You worked in corporate Australia and then you came across. And it's been my observation over the last few terms in particular that that politics is sort of becoming hostile territory for humans.
Yeah, it's really I wish I'd called my book that, actually.
No, but it's sort of like, look, at one level there are it's just I have witnessed this phenomenon time and time again, sadly, that lateral recruits, people like you, who have had a life and a bunch of experiences outside what happens in this building, often just hit the fence because it's sort of because the culture from which you've come can't be aligned with the culture in which you find yourself in terms of politics. Now, I don't want to sound completely pessimistic or nihilistic about that because you know, you weren't here for a long time, but you were here for a good time in terms of, you know, I'm not diminishing your service in it at all.
No.
It's just this point that we do need humans in politics. We do need them, yet the environment makes it very difficult.
Yeah. And it's sort of like in corporate and in any other sector, if you start a new job, or a new employer, you go to a new employer, you have an induction process and not the sort of, you know, school for what do they call it?
Poly school.
Which is, you know, here's the toilet blocks are here and, you know, don't take photos in the chamber.
And that one's the speaker.
Even that, like, just a funny aside, but I remember I've got the sense of direction of a Cocker Spaniel. I remember walking around the house with the tour guide and I'm thinking, okay, I can place it where that piece of art is, you know. And then just at that time the tour guide said, and don't mark out places because of the art because we rotate.
I was going to say, oh, yes, no. I'm pretty sure the art rotates still.
Yes,
oh, God.
But that it was all housekeeping items.
Yes.
And indeed, yes. Even the sort of recent discussion, like I threw it in the mix in terms of the presence of alcohol in the place, you know, that to me again is a housekeeping item that was dealt with back in the 80s. Mm. I spoke to like the New York Times wrote about this, that in the White House is a completely dry environment,
yeah,
except for you know function areas. Mm. Obviously.
Mm.
And But those are all housekeeping, because culture is defined by the leader. And, you know, my job, a big part of my job was workplace culture and governance.
Yes.
And I spent my life training new employees, training current employees, training older employees. Like, we'd have to rotate governance training about our code of conduct and all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Every few months. And now it's being implemented here like it's something new.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And, you know, it's sort of like the corporate world dealt with the fact that you can't report something into an HR director if the HR director is a sexual harasser.
Yes.
Like, they dealt with that, you know, back in the 90s. And
why do you think it's taken such a long time? Because it's sort of this, as you say, right?
Yeah.
This conversation is only just happening now.
Yeah.
We're having over the last 6 months, and we're going to get right into the last 6 months and
yeah.
the importance of
yeah.
it. But it's just now. We're talking for the first time. Oh,
yeah.
Let's train senior staff how
yeah.
not to sexually harass staff
yeah.
or to deal with complaints. And
absolutely.
Why has that not happened here?
I don't look, from my perspective, you know, I pretty much got the rough draft of my book ready by around March.
Mm-hmm.
It was sort of like the rough structure, the, you know, the chapters. And then, of course, the Brittany Higgins event and the cascade of events coming out of Parliament House and now all these changes proposed. And I thought to myself, if I published that book in March and was asked to publish a sequel, I would have called the sequel Told You. That's what I would have called it, quite honestly, because I think the rest of the world, you know, the rest of Australia in human land would just think, really? Is it really like that? I've had so many of my friends, you know, ask me. You know,
yeah, just how can this be?
How can this be?
Yeah, and I've done a lot on the podcast over the last 6 months just
yeah.
trying to explain this phenomenon to
yeah.
people that normal HR practices do not operate
yeah.
in this building.
Yeah.
I mean, they do in my organisation.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
not in the organisation that you were in.
That's right.
And tell me about booze too, because you mentioned booze.
Yeah.
Right. So, yeah. Look, I'm curious about this because journalism was another profession with a huge boozing
yeah.
culture.
Yeah.
But now, well, certainly here.
Yeah.
No one would drink except, like, you know, I don't know, someone's birthday or
that's right.
some, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
You have a glass of champagne. Like, no one hits the booze
no.
along this corridor now.
No.
So what happens downstairs? What people just...
Well, every MP has booze in, almost every other MP has booze in their office. And it's sort of, and there's a countless number of events going on everywhere.
Yes.
And there is a real culture that, you know, well, we'll get the... you know, free drinks or the pre-dinner drinks. I remember I went to one event and I lasted about 2 minutes because the poor woman, the waitress who came out with a tray of champagne mm. glasses, and it was a massive event where everyone, all MPs and all their staff were invited, and she hadn't even come out from behind the screen and people ran to, to
like
grab
just
it.
Mobbed her.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
And I thought, my God, it's like an 18th birthday party. Like, really, I was actually disgusted.
Like boarding
I'm not,
school
I'm
without
not
prude, the
rules. Right?
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I just, it was just quite shocking to me. And you know, the really funny thing for me, it's almost, are you serious, was that people say, oh, you know, she entered politics because she was so naive. Like, Naive, right? Naive.
Sorry.
It was just, I wasn't naive, okay? I just thought there would be some semblance of normal culture, you know, aligned to, you know, corporate culture.
Yes, and exactly. Well, a set of expectations that
right.
most
yeah.
of the rest of us are yeah. familiar with.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that, yeah. you know, most senior executives, by the time they get to my level, if you change a job, you fast adapt to the new culture. But here, you know, and that's what my expectation was. But you try and fast adapt, but you realize that you can't adapt because the practices are so antiquated. Like, for example, I worked in, you know, the corporate space in crisis and risk management.
Yep.
That was, you know, I led many crisis risk management teams. I worked in the pharmaceutical business. So if you have a product recall of a pharmaceutical, I actually worked for the company during the swine flu pandemic, right? So I saw, you know, crisis management I led it basically. And the one thing you do about all good companies do after they've gone through a corporate crisis is you do an after action review, no mm-hmm. matter how small or how big the crisis, so you can look at things you've learned,
mm.
you know, what you could have done better, what you did really well, all that sort of thing, and then apply that to the future processes. So when I won the election, when my team and I won yeah. the election,
yeah.
I just assumed that I would be swamped with requests from within the Liberal Party to say, actually, you did it differently to all of us, you know.
What can we learn from you?
What can we learn from
given
you?
Given you're the only seat that you...
I wasn't asked once. I just wasn't asked. I wasn't interviewed. I wasn't nothing. I thought they would want me to speak at events. You know, the young Liberals, I used to sort of have a go at them, and, you know, it turns out that the president of the Young Liberals was always a young Liberal man, of course. And I'd say, you know, I'm happy to come along as a speaker. Wouldn't that be refreshing? Have a woman and, you know, someone who
won.
Right.
Yeah.
And I remember I was ribbing him about it just before the coup in 2018. And I said, who have you got for your Young Liberal ball this year? And, you know, why haven't you asked me? I've offered so many times. And he said, we've got Tony Abbott this year. I thought, okay, I'm done. That's it. Right. I'm done.
Just on that, like, your post-crisis review, right?
Oh, yeah.
You and I need to get to sexism in a moment because you and I have many feelings on this subject. Just in that post-crisis review mode, the other thing that's very common in serious corporations is the exit interview.
Of course,
right?
Yeah.
When you move.
Yeah.
People want to understand why you've left.
Yeah.
And what your reflections are on the culture and all of
yeah.
that sort of stuff, right?
Yeah.
Did you have an exit review?
Oh, no.
What's the book, really, isn't it?
If you count the exit review of the social media trolling that I continued to get saying, ha, 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 you lost, you know, no.
No.
I didn't. In fact, the trolling, I thought it would stop once I lost, but it just got so bad. And from leaders, you know, former Liberal leaders, you know, they were all just gloating. And I remember... it just got so stupid and revolting. I literally deleted my Twitter account, Facebook. I just thought, nah,
just let
it all go because yeah. I dealt with it all during the election. And then it just kept going and going.
Well, you must really get under their skin. well, seriously.
Yeah, well, I don't know. It was quite an interesting experience for me. I remember during the independent campaign, and we had a big community event to which I was invited for the business association in Flinders mm. electorate.
Mm.
There was probably about 200 people there, and Greg Hunt was there, and of course, and I got up and made my speech. And I started my speech, and it was just completely spontaneous. But because I'd been talking to people just before it and everything, and I said, I can't tell you how good it is to breathe the business air again, you know, not the parliament air. And that sort of brought the floor down, and, you know, I got walked down, and people within earshot of Greg Hunt, which I don't think he really liked very much, but, you know, was saying, That was the best, you know, speech by far. You know, you get business and blah blah blah. It was just really extraordinary because it for me, I actually felt the contrast.
Yeah, viscerally. You felt it in your soul, in you as a human. Yes.
Yeah. Let's touch down now on sexism because we've referenced it on the way through.
Yeah.
And as you said, what's the reference in your book? It's like a cross between Mad Men and House of Cards, right? Yeah. So why do you think the Liberal and National parties? Because I do actually think on this, there are quantifiable differences between the major parties. That has not always been the case. Mm. In my reporting lifetime, Labor started off really no different to the Liberal and National parties in terms of that default feminism or not, right?
Right, yeah.
Like the two cultures were actually very similar when I started in the mid-90s.
Yeah, yeah.
And what's happened in the Labor Party through affirmative action and quotas and all that sort of stuff is now this critical mass.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that everybody and every bloke you meet in the Labor Party is a feminist. I mean, quite the contrary.
Yeah.
But there's now a sort of starting position in Labor that's quite different to where things started, right?
Yeah.
In the Liberal and National parties, it does remain a boys' club.
Absolutely.
And again, I don't look, Julie Bishop, if you're listening, Kelly O'Dwyer, if you're listening, all these, Kay Patterson, if you're listening, Judy Troth, if you're listening, like, you know, of course, right? Like, you've had some superb women.
Yes, absolutely.
Like really fantastic, right?
Yeah.
So, but inherently it's a boys' club. Why?
It's because of the numbers. Like the numbers don't answer everything in terms of parity, in terms of gender equal leadership. But as we know, the Labor Party introduced quotas in the mid-90s. And I can't speak through the lens of the Labor Party.
Yeah.
And I'm sure, like you...
Well, I've never been a member of it either. I'm just observing,
but
right?
I'm sure that we all still see the headlines. So I'm sure their culture is not perfect.
No.
It's certainly not the panacea. But it is a critical core piece towards gender equality, to have that gender equal leadership. I saw that transformation in the corporate world, you know, when I started out and I was on boards, it was like 9 men and I was one of two women on the board. And I remember when targets were introduced, which you can introduce in corporate because you can incentivize it to people's salaries.
Yes.
And you even it up, the dialogue is different.
Yeah.
And if I can point to an example that, for example, I thought the Labor Party's policy on childcare that they introduced last year was signature.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't for a minute think that Albo got up one morning and thought, I'm going to introduce this childcare policy. I think it has everything to do with the fact that they have a balanced number of men and women in their party. It makes a difference. It changes the dialogue.
I think that's right. But also, and I mean, it sort of seems a bit silly to kind of raise this, because in a way, what I'm trying to say is, okay, childcare is a good example, Julia, right?
Yeah.
So Labor comes up with a childcare policy.
Yeah.
Obviously, they've got people like Tanya Plibersek and Amanda Rishworth and those women driving that, as well as blokes who, you know, are not from the Stone Age.
Yeah.
In your own party room, though, your former party room, we saw a debate recently about whether childcare should even be a thing.
Yeah, that's right. It's outsourcing parenting.
Outsourcing parenting.
And, you know, I was observing that obviously through the press, and I know how that party room works. And, first of all, it was only the women who spoke up.
Yeah.
The few women that are there who challenged it. Oh, there was, I think, Jason Falinski might have as well. But fundamentally, that voice, that's great for the party room, but that's going to get drowned out because they haven't got the numbers.
Mm.
They haven't got the numbers or the voice. And just as I've argued that that party room, with the number of climate deniers and the dynamics of that party room, I mean, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to work out that, you know, the moderates' voice has been drowned out on climate change action.
Yeah.
It's similar in relation to issues which relate to which relate to women in the workplace, even their perception that childcare is a woman's issue, yes. it's actually
yes, rather than
it's
a family
actually not
issue.
In a modern than, corporate, yes. it's, you know, it's,
everybody exactly. has parental responsibility.
Exactly.
Yeah. And, but it's know, that problem yeah. And again, like, I'm not saying this through a lens where I think conservative voices shouldn't be represented in the nation's parliament, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, conservatism is
of course
a
yeah.
valid philosophical
yeah.
you know tradition that mm. obviously should be represented mm. in the nation's parliament
yeah.
but it sort of becomes more complicated for the Liberal and National parties because there is this sort of critical mass of conservative blokes.
That's
it's
right.
not just that there's not enough women, although mm. that's absolutely right.
Yeah.
It's that the blokes that yeah. are there are yeah. like a couple of decades behind
that's
in
right.
their thinking.
Yeah, yeah.
So what do you do about that?
Well, it again, I believe the leader defines the culture. I do believe Morrison has a very traditional view, which he holds viscerally. And I'm not being critical of stay-at-home mums, but any view beyond that traditional mm. homemaker mm. is a view that is held by a number of men in that party room. It just is. And sure, there are women in that party room, as there were when I was there, that have a different background. There are women in that party room, like a lot of the men in the party room, who are career politicians as well. But nonetheless, if you have this intensive conservative voice and you couple that with, and it's male as well, mm. you're not going to get sound policy because half our population are severely underrepresented
mm. in the nation's parliament.
In the nation's parliament.
Mm. Mm. And the sort of sexism, anyone who's watched your interviews associated with your book, we'll know that that incident you recount in the Prime Minister's office, that really terrible incident that you recount in the Prime Minister's office where yeah. a colleague sexually harassed you.
Yeah.
Is that, do you think, I mean, obviously you've recounted that example.
Yeah.
Do you think that that is a very common experience?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I'm not saying it doesn't happen in the corporate world where there are structures and there are mechanisms mm, and there
sure.
are whistleblower
yeah,
systems.
Yeah. Sure.
But it's probably more covert in the corporate system. But at least there is some semblance of system or recourse.
Yeah.
But it's not to say that there are, you know, thousands of women out there in corporate land who are keeping their secrets as well because of their job or whatever. I recount that incident, even though far worse has happened to me, as I'm sure to millions of women, far worse. And women are dealing with this every single day. You know, and then you hear that trope about not all men and, you know, well, of course not all men. And women know that not all men are sexist, misogynist, philanderers, whatever, or bullies. Women know that. We know that. We're married to them. We work with them. Mm. You know, all my bosses invariably have been male, middle-aged men, and, you know, most of them, 90% of them are amazing individuals.
Yeah.
But we also know, and this is the critical stat, that 98% of women don't make up these stories.
Yeah.
They don't make up these stories. And what is particularly annoying is when other women come out and say, well, it's not like that for me. It's a perfect world. That is just, like, seriously, okay, maybe you've walked through life, you know.
Yes, somehow.
And you haven't had any, you know, sexist behaviour at all happen. Yeah, fantastic. But it doesn't mean that I'm making it up.
No, and look, good luck if you've managed to get through life either not being sexually harassed yourself or not knowing anybody who has been sexually harassed or worse.
Yes.
And most of us do know someone who's been through something worse than that.
Yeah.
Good luck to you. Yeah. But understand that you are not representative.
That's right.
Well, that's not, like, the data shows that those experiences, those blessed experiences of unencumbered femaleness in male domains, that's not that's the exception. That's not the rule.
That's right. And it all it does, I mean, you can see this is the really disturbing bit about it, is it just, it's simply harnessing the gendered stereotype.
Yes.
It is just simply saying, well, sending the women out to say, well, she's a liar, or, you know, it didn't happen to me, that, you know, all the blokes are beautiful.
Yeah. No, it's silencing. It needs to be called for what it is, a form of silencing.
And it's a completely absurd. And the other completely absurd one that's come out in the last few days is, you know, Senator Henderson saying that somehow, and this was said during the independent campaign, that I was tricked by the Labor Party.
Well, this is your naivety again.
Yeah.
Remember?
That I'd moved from Malcolm Turnbull telling me what to do every day after he left to now it was the Labor Party. Suddenly, you know, I haven't got a mind of my own. No. I didn't make those decisions.
Well, that's of course, like a woman without a brain, of course, has a stellar corporate career with men just telling her what to do. I mean, obviously, oh, my God, when will it stop?
She's
seriously.
Like, this, first of all, she's this weak petal. Oh, damn it, she won't shut up. Okay, right. She must be being told what to do by these horrible Labor people and Malcolm Turnbull or whoever, some man somewhere.
Let's end this way because I've seen, I mean, it's as is always the case in these conversations, you and I could go on for about 4 hours. But anyway, we're only just warming up, really. But anyway, no. I have seen over the last couple of days, I've seen in preview the first couple of episodes of a series that's coming up on the ABC.
Yeah.
I think next week, I think it drops. I'm not entirely certain.
Yeah.
But this is the series you may have seen promos, guys. Annabelle Crabb is fronting a series on women in the parliament called Misrepresented, which is quite fun. I've seen, the first couple of episodes. What has struck me it's enormously powerful.
Yeah.
To see you all there, a bunch of you across the political spectrum sharing, I mean, the experiences are so common that there's some lovely editing cuts in it where one woman starts the story and another woman finishes it.
Right.
It's the same story.
Right.
It's so universal.
Yes. Yeah.
Right. And it's really powerful, those sort of narration devices.
Yeah.
But look, I've known, there are some women from, you know, perhaps from the 70s who I've not had any dealings with. Mm. Most of the women on the program are women of my generation in terms of in the parliament.
Mm.
So I know most of you. I've seen you operate professionally over a long period of time and how careful women are in politics because it's so easy to blow yourself up.
That's right.
But to see you all, I can only describe it as a truth has possessed you all. I'm not suggesting that you spent your time here lying, but there's something about what's happened in the last 6 months that has given a bunch of you a license to just tell it like it is without having to think about, oh, will I offend some bloke if I say it this way or will people be repelled by my message?
Yeah.
So did you ever think in this journey from your old life to the political life, that you would end up, you know, in these circumstances where you're part of a movement. And obviously what needs to change in Australia is well beyond what happens in the parliament. What needs to happen in Australia is what happens out there in the world.
Yeah.
But I think it's been wonderful for me to see political women just absolutely prioritising truth in their recounts of stories. So what does it feel like to be part of this minor
really,
revolution?
To your point, like during my term, if there's one thing I would never do and it's compromise my values. So I always talked about...
Yeah, you did.
The
absolutely.
Quotas,
yeah,
for quotas,
you did.
Even though I was quietly told... Don't mention the Q word.
The Q word. Well, you can't even say the word quota. Right.
Quotas are a Labor solution to a Liberal problem. Don't mention the F word, being a feminist. And I did all of that. And what I didn't realise when I announced I wasn't going to recontest the next election, I was going to do the corporate thing. You know, I was going to sit back on the backbench, continue to serve through my term so that I could continue to advocate and all the rest of it. But I wanted to continue that thread of honesty in the politest way possible. And I put one line in there saying, you know, workplace entrenched culture or bullying and intimidation, which I've experienced from the opposition and from within my own party. Those were the deadly words because
Like the traitorous words?
The traitorous words. Yeah. She's a traitor, treachery, terrible, horrible. Let's make her, you know, let's take her through the sexist spectrum somehow. Let's silence her. Let's create fear. All of those things. I didn't realise that I would, with those words, become the whistleblower. And, you know, the open whistleblower in 2018.
It's pretty weird role reversal when you think about you as sort of general counsel in like you're the guy or the woman with the telescope waiting for the whistleblower to jump them, right? Like, so anyway, it's pretty sort of funny role reversal to find
and
yourself
in. You know, they tried to minimise it to, well, she'd experienced bullying during the coup week. No, that's not what I was calling it. I'd witnessed other women, certainly, it turned out that those other women who were really quite affected by the bullying, I'd experienced my share, but I could handle it. Like, I've sat in courtrooms. It was those other women who came out and said, oh, actually, it wasn't bullying. It was just a bit of lobbying. And like, oh, no, we're going to deal with this by internal reviews. That was just, and then I had the bloke saying, and Morrison, you know, Captain Number One, saying that I was an emotional wreck, like just through this whole stereotype. And, you know, I think hopefully we've moved beyond the internal review that goes nowhere.
Yeah.
And hopefully there will be these structures. But as we said at the outset, they are years behind. And until there is leadership and accountability and the tough calls are made, then
nothing will
change.
Yeah. Well, things have to change.
Yeah.
Let's end on this. If there are young women listening, and there will be, a surprising number of young women actually approached me about the pod, which is delightful.
That's fantastic.
It is.
It is.
So so we can be both confident we're talking to young women.
Yeah.
If you're a young woman listening to this conversation but you think you really want to get into politics because it's the only way to change the country, right?
Yeah.
What would you say to them?
I'd say to them, during their career journey, always make sure your values aren't compromised and that they're aligned to the leader's values, the ultimate leader's values, not just the corporation's values, but the leader, because the leader will define the culture. And always, always put trust at the top of your list. If that's not there, then find another pathway. But I think, you know, that's what we need. And may I say, my experience outside of the Liberal Party when I became an independent, outside the constraints of the major parties, the community, like we got 200 volunteers within 5 weeks, and there were it was just this whole vibe of politics with purpose, and people really wanted, because people are out there, and that's why I really believe that to have a circuit breaker in our body politic, we need the independents to have, we need the independents to make up the balance of power and to be sensible centrists, preferably women, to balance the numbers out as well. Mm. But I think only then will we get real action on climate change, on humanitarian issues, because the thing about an independent has far more power than a backbencher of a major party, because you have that direct interface with your constituents. So you know exactly what, you know, people want, what your community wants, and you're able to implement that, to fight for that if you've got the balance of power.
Yeah.
Whereas in a major party, your voice can be drowned out in, you know, in the party room or beforehand, particularly if there isn't the numbers of women. But I really look forward to a time when, you know, I was told that the Liberal Party would seriously have considered quotas if they'd lost the last election. I really believe mandatory quotas is an urgent imperative for Australian federal politics, for us to have good representation of the Australian population.
And a lovely note to finish on, Julia. Thank you. I appreciate this conversation. I appreciate the forbearance of our audience listening to us catching up because we haven't seen each other face to face for ages, which is so it's been a really delightful conversation. If there's any questions, Julia is back on the socials now.
I'm on Twitter and Facebook. I'm not on Facebook.
Oh, you're on Twitter. Yeah, okay, so you easily what's your handle on Twitter?
Julia H. Banks.
Okay, Julia H. Banks. So if there are young women or men who have a more specific question that they want to put to you that's been triggered by anything in the conversation,
absolutely,
give her a shout and I'm sure she'll get back to you.
And I'm on LinkedIn as well.
Oh, on LinkedIn. Oh, my God. Yeah. Well, I'm not corporate
for my corporate friends
LinkedIn.
Out there.
Yes, exactly. Right. Okay, very good. Yeah. And the book is called Power Play and it is in bookshops now if you want to track it down. Thank you. As always, to my executive producer, Miles Martignoni, and thank you to you guys for listening, sharing, telling others about the podcast, etc. We'll be back next week.
Thanks so much, Murph. It's so great to be here.
Lovely.
And thank you.
Okay.
Thanks.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.